This podcast is not legal advice and should not be relied upon as such. You should always obtain legal advice about your specific circumstances.
Hello there. Welcome to the latest podcast from the Horne Wilcox Equity Capital Markets team. I'm John Hutchinson. Today I'm joined by James Morvell, a corporate partner in our Melbourne office, and by Savan Gore, a corporate partner in our Perth office. Welcome to you both.
Thanks very much, John.
Good morning, John.
Morning. In another podcast in the series, we'll be talking about the challenging economic environment and the implications that can have for companies wishing to raise capital. Today, I think it's less about threat and more about opportunity, in particular the opportunity for listed companies to buy unlisted companies or assets. So maybe Savan, maybe we'll start with you. How would you say acquisitions by a listed company may differ to those by their non-listed competitors?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, John. Well, I guess one of the sort of key differences is that there is an additional level of regulatory overlay. Listed companies are subject to the ASX listing rules, which add an additional level of requirements when undertaking an acquisition. So for example, they might prevent certain types of acquisitions from occurring, for example, backdoor listings, or may require shareholder approval in order to proceed with the acquisition.
Yep. Anything else about?
Yeah, look, I mean, given that the transaction becomes public, there's obviously going to be a greater level of public scrutiny of listed company acquisitions as opposed to those in the private space. And so, I think entities undertaking, listed acquisitions should be expecting greater regulatory and media interest in the transaction and plan accordingly, by ensuring that you're quite clear on what regulatory approvals are needed and how best to manage those, and that you have a very clear public relations strategy to deal with media and shareholder inquiries.
Okay. James?
Well, touching on a couple of those things that Savan raised, I think two other issues that are somewhat more unique for listed acquirers. The fact that there are more stakeholder interests involved in any transaction such as this. So in particular, you're inevitably dealing with a larger shareholder base than most private enterprises. And whilst you're not having to look to what requirements there may be under a shareholders agreement or what approvals might be required contractually, shareholders are going to be aware of the public scrutiny, and there are situations that will come to where they may indeed have to provide their approval, and the disclosure to those shareholders is quite critical. Also having regard to the fact that most listed companies will have a combination of institutional shareholders and retail, otherwise known as mum and dad shareholders, on their register with different levels of sophistication and interest in a transaction. And then finally, I would just also add that whilst we'd always implore any board of directors, regardless of whether they're on a private company board or a listed company, to exercise a thorough process in conducting an acquisition, it's just the case that due to all the other factors that Savan's mentioned around the scrutiny and the fact that these are public deals, there is a greater risk for directors. Their duties will be more carefully examined. They have to run the gauntlet of managing disclosure all the way through the life cycle of a transaction. So it is very important that directors are adopting a thorough process and a strong governance framework with their management team.
So I suppose the kind of scenario I'm thinking about is an auction process to buy an asset where we're in competition with an unlisted company. What are the sort of regulatory restrictions which might apply to a listed company, which might slow down our ability to capture the opportunity?
Yeah, thanks, John. Perhaps one thing I'll mention is, under the ASX listing rules, there are a couple of somewhat unique requirements that certainly don't apply to private competitors who might also be considering an acquisition and maybe involved in the bid process. One comes up under Chapter 11 of the listing rules. So this is a, rather unique from a corporate perspective for companies in that listed companies need to be aware of whether an acquisition will trigger a requirement to potentially have to recomply with the admission tests under the ASX listing rules. So what does that mean? It means that ASX might regard certain acquisitions as fundamentally changing the nature or scale of that listed entity, the acquirer, to the point that, you know, the ASX would say, well, you know, because of that fundamental change, you really should go back to re-qualify as a listed entity.
Yeah.
And practically,
yes, that's what makes, you know, we hear a lot of talk periodically about backdoor listings and that kind of thing. But in sort of my experience, they're actually very difficult to achieve because of that sort of consideration you're talking about, James, they need to go back to shareholders.
Well, that's exactly right, John. And I think this is one of the, you know, it becomes a real, really important threshold issue when any acquisition is being considered. And you know, probably at an early stage and on a confidential basis, engaging with the ASX to have a discussion about the potential transaction and how it would affect the entity. Now, it's interesting that the change test really looks at, you know, in a broad sense, around a 25% impact. That said, the impact can be on a range of different financial metrics. So consolidated assets, consolidated earnings, et cetera, et cetera. So there are, ASX sort of throws a bucket at these transactions to say, well, if you hit the 25% on any of those, it could well trigger this requirement under Chapter 11. But yeah, in our experience, ASX is, you know, is good at facilitating those early discussions. And in fact, is quite reasonable, where even if we had a transaction in the last 24 months where it did exceed 25% on one of those metrics, but certainly not on any of the others. And ASX was quite reasonable in putting its position that it would not enforce any Chapter 11 readmission requirements. So it's a really important step, though, because you don't want to get to the point where you've just about to execute a deal, or worse still, yes, you've announced a deal without having gone through that consultation with the ASX.
Yeah. No, thanks for that, James. And you mentioned the word confidentiality, which I sort of guess leads naturally to the topic of continuous disclosure, Savan, which clearly applies to...
Exactly. Yeah, look, it's certainly very important for listed entities. Obviously, they are subject to continuous disclosure obligations under Listing Rule 3.1. And so, you know, if you are in the midst of negotiating a transaction, the last thing you want is to have to, you know, make an announcement before you've agreed any particular deal. The listing rules allow you to withhold the details of the transaction whilst it remains incomplete and confidential. And so it becomes extremely important to ensure that, you know, confidentiality is not lost during that negotiation process, because otherwise, you know, you will potentially be required to make an announcement and disclose, you know, potentially, you know, who you're negotiating with, what the terms are, which is obviously not ideal, you know, could put the transaction in jeopardy. So it really is key to ensure that you have proper, you know, confidentiality arrangements in place. You keep your deal teams, you know, as small as possible. You know, you limit the flow of information to those who actually need it, so that you really are minimizing the risk of a potential leak. And then obviously you still need a plan for the worst case. So it is really important to ensure that you have, you know, a form of leak announcement in place, which I guess is a sort of draft announcement, which you can prepare and can then be tailored if, you know, a leak does arise, so that, you know, you can be quite proactive and you can react accordingly, rather than sort of scrambling to deal with the situation.
Yeah. So, there's clearly a few more hurdles to jump over. And James, I imagine that, as is always the case, the path to success is careful advanced planning. Would you agree with that?
I think it is, John. And I think that's where, you know, in the current market as well, you know, we're expecting, in fact, we're already starting to see, you know, in the M&A activity, a number of, you know, opportunistic transactions, if we call it that. So they're not necessarily distressed deals, but they're acquisitions that come up fairly quickly. And, you know, what we're seeing is that those parties who have the best chance of succeeding are those that are well prepared in advance. So they might not even be prepared for the particular deal, but to some of the points that Sivan was raising, they've got a deal team, or they've got people who they can readily assemble as a deal team. And they've got various, I suppose, arrangements in place internally to know how they're going to manage information and keep it tight. They know who they're going to appoint as third-party advisors quickly to deal with, you know, legal due diligence, financial and tax, and even potentially have their own buy-side advisor to help them through, whether it's a bid process or even a bilateral negotiation. And and they're aware also of what they're going to need to do with regulators. So we've talked about the ASX clearly, but unfortunately, it doesn't stop there. We know the ACCC is currently revisiting its merger clearance process and the requirements that will apply there. But you've always got to have regard to the commission and be thinking about the market and whether a deal is likely to need to go before the ACCC. So I think there's a number of things that go to the planning, and we're obviously particularly interested in the legal matters. Of course, then there are financial and operational issues that certain preparatory steps can be taken in order to put listed companies at least on par with their private competitors, who perhaps are a little more nimble and less exposed to some of these regulatory burdens in the preparation.
And I guess to sort of follow on from what, James is saying there about preparation, and sort of touching on the financial aspects, another key step obviously will be funding and where that funding will come from.
Sure.
Particularly if you're competing against, well-funded private entities.
Just on that, Savannah, I mentioned at the outset that we're going to be talking about capital raising in another podcast, but since I've got you both on the line, is there any sort of comments either of you would make about raising equity capital in this environment, or in particular through placements?
One thing I would say about the raising of capital is that, quite usually a placement may well be accompanied with another form of offer structure, be a rights offer or an SPP. It may be to maximise, how much can be raised depending on the acquisition size. Sure. But it may also just be from a shareholder relations perspective that the register wouldn't be super supportive of going to existing or bringing some new institutional investors, but that everyone should have an opportunity. And so when we get to that point, I think now we're also introducing sort of another stream, which is with both the listed company, its broker, and then of course the lawyers to be working through, well, how would we structure that raise? And importantly, how does that raise get sequenced into the transaction? And again, that's something where we've found some real challenges, but not insurmountable, but in really working through what the necessary time frame for a raise can be, and what's the shortest possible time. But then sometimes how does that even fit in with where, which we'll probably come to talking a little bit more about, where you do in fact need to go to shareholders for one or more approvals. How are you fitting in your capital raise within that, and getting into issues of conditionality and other problems that can arise if you haven't had the forward planning?
The sellers of assets don't like conditional agreements.
No.
The market doesn't like conditional capital raisings.
Exactly. And I think that's where it's probably those early conversations with, your brokers, or if you're lucky, your underwriters, to, get a sense of, well, what is the appetite for this deal? And having those strong relationships so you can have those confidential discussions early to make sure that it is the right deal and that you will be able to raise sufficient capital on the back of it.
That's great. So we've covered a fair amount of ground in a relatively short time. Before we leave it, is there anything else, either James or Sivan, you'd like to comment on?
Well, no, I'd probably just touch on John, which is not an issue that is certainly specific to listed companies, but obviously de-risking transactions is an important consideration for any board of directors and management team. And, one tool that obviously has becoming more and more prevalent in M&A is warranty and indemnity insurance. And so, where W&I Insurance is involved in a transaction, It does have sort of some flow-on impacts. You know, it can have, of course, the desired outcome of mitigating risk. You know, it mitigates the seller's risk because it limits, you know, the potential claims against them. But I suppose, importantly, for what we're thinking of today, for a listed buyer, it also reduces counterparty risk, that if there is a claim, you know, you've got an insurer standing behind it rather than a counterparty who may not be in the money as it would be. But it does have impacts on, you know, the extent and the form of due diligence that's required. Because of course, you know, an underwriter and their counsel, insurance underwriter and their counsel rather, will be very involved in the process of considering the transaction risks before they will write a policy. So that's yet another, you know, implication to be considering at an early stage. Now, sometimes it's driven by a seller, but often the case is more that it's part of a, you know, a buyer's, you know, offer or package that the deal is put together. So I'd certainly implore our listed clients to be thinking a lot about, you know, what risk mitigation factors they're going to apply to a deal. And if W&I is one, starting that process quite early as well.
Yeah, no, that's great. Thanks, James. Savan, anything else from you?
I think the only other thing to add, and sort of touching again on sort of continuous disclosure, would just be that, you know, if you are looking to, you know, fund an acquisition through equity, and as a result, you know, you will need to make full disclosure via cleansing notices or, you know, even disclosure documents to the market, that if you're doing anything else, you know, separate to the acquisition, which is material, and you're relying on the carve-outs from disclosure, that you have to bear in mind that, you know, that information will need to be disclosed as part of any equity raising transaction. And so that's just something to sort of bear in mind. And it's not just the particular transaction that needs to be disclosed, but anything else that's material going on in the organization will also need to be adequately disclosed, that the market is fully cleansed.
Very good. Well, thank you both. Thanks everyone for listening today. As always, please get in touch with us if you have any questions. You can find our details on our website, which is hornandwilcox.com.au, or connect with us on LinkedIn. If you enjoyed today's episode, then please rate, review, or follow our podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you.